On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats to answer these questions. Is this the most competitive first round ever? And what does Milwaukee's shocking collapse tell us about the future of Giannis and the Milwaukee Bucks? And also, with Cade Cunningham and Jalen Duren showing out, is Detroit already ahead of schedule in their rebuild? Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to The Big Number. I'm Tom Habersher. We do this every week here at Yahoo Sports with my guy, Dan Devine. Dan, what's going on, man?
Tom, I had meant to get here a little earlier, but I was standing at the scorer's table for like 2.5 minutes and I couldn't get back in the game. So my bad, that's on me. You know, it's a coach's decision. We just got to play through it. But now I'm back in. I'm here. I'm ready to go. And I want you to lay it out for me, man. Let's put up some numbers. What is this week's big number, Tom Haberstroh?
This week's big number, Dan, is 11. That's the number of postseason games this year that have been decided by 3 points or fewer. Ooh. One possession games. We've got 11 of them. And if you think that sounds like a lot, it's because it is, Dan. We've never seen, in the last decade, we haven't seen this many first round games end with a margin as little as 3 points, 2 points, 1 point. One possession games have been happening all over the place. And you were present for one of them on Tuesday night at Madison Square Garden. How crazy was that one?
Yeah, I thought you were going to say the big number is 11 because that's Jalen Brunson's number. And he was standing on the sideline at the scorer's table waiting to check back in crunch time. Yeah, I mean, it feels like the entirety of Knicks Pistons has been played inside of 3 points. I know that's not literally true, but spiritually it feels true. I was in the building for game five. Detroit comes out that do or die. They got to get the win. They get the win. 106-103. Cade Cunningham winds up being the crunch time director, as you know, taking that mantle from Jalen Brunson to extend Detroit's season. And that is, I mean, some of these close and tight endings and these, you know, remarkable, exciting finishes have been one team making a dramatic comeback or a huge run or a buzzer beater. And with Knicks Pistons, a lot of it's just like two heavyweights fighting in a phone booth and whoever can land one more shot on the button is the one that's going to take it. Detroit does it and extends back to game six. So it's exciting, but like, it's a grueling kind of excitement as opposed to the exhilarating kind I think we're seeing in some of the other series.
Yeah, it's an insane postseason. I mean, you got Luka and LeBron staving off, you know, elimination against Anthony Edwards and the Minnesota Timberwolves. That's been an awesome series, and it might be not even like a top four series in the postseason. Right. You look at Giannis Antetokounmpo and what happened in that game down the stretch in overtime in an elimination game to go up 7 points with 40 seconds left and have an all-time collapse. I've never seen anything like it, and we'll get into this later in the show, but that was insane. And what we saw after the game with Giannis and Tyrese Halliburton's dad having this like weird showdown, this postseason has had, in terms of the stakes, in terms of the star power, Jokic going against Kawhi Leonard and James Harden, the buzzer beaters. This has been ridiculous. And I do think that when we step back and look at how blessed we've been to watch some of these close games, it bears repeating that we've had 11 one-possession games in this first round, which is, if you look at a percentage basis, we haven't had this many compared to how many games we've already seen. We're not even done with the first round yet, Dan. We've seen 11 of these games. 31% of the postseason so far has been a one-possession game. The final margin, 1, 2, or 3 points. That is the most that we've seen in any postseason since the modern-day postseason went to 7 games in the first round. So basically, this is what we're on track for, is we're on track for the most electric, the most star-studded, the most ridiculous postseason of our recent times. So this postseason, look, we've got Denver, the Clippers. We've got on the other side of the bracket, we've got Milwaukee having the craziest collapse maybe in postseason history, where they're up by 7 points and blow it with a Gary Trent turnover and then drops the ball, as Nate Duncan said, a la Bill Buckner. And that pains me as a Red Sox fan over here. Any sort of allusion to Bill Buckner, we can't just let him be. I don't know. So that, look, man, I feel like you were at the game. Were you keeping track of the Milwaukee game? Did you think that one was over?
Yeah, so because of the staggered starts with a four-game Tuesday, which really brutal, you know, for those of us who have to try to be up on four series to talk about it on a microphone the next day, not all that fun. But I was sitting next to James Herbert, who does a wonderful job for CBS Sports, and he had the game up on his laptop. At first, we were sort of tracking the score, and it was like, all right, it's 7 with 40 seconds left, like it's over. And when he turned the game on, we saw Doc Rivers' face. The Doc Rivers face on the sideline, and we both immediately went, oh no, something has happened. And then to see that it comes down, like it was just a growing feeling of even the people around that laptop. I'm like, no, that can't be what, that cannot be the way this game ends. That cannot be the way this series ends. It cannot be the way Giannis Antetokounmpo's time in Milwaukee ends, TBD. Like everything, it felt like this is what an unbelievable set of circumstances to arrive at this point. And to your point, like a lot of that energy feels like it is sort of suffused through this first round. As you have so many, and you talk about the stakes and the heavyweights that are there, it's like the previous generation, the current generation, the oncoming generation where Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is leading the charge for Oklahoma City. You've got sort of Donovan Mitchell and Evan Mobley, Darius Garland, that whole crew in Cleveland kind of going through. Tyrese Halliburton, obviously a pretty divisive figure based on the anonymous reporting of The Athletic that marks him, according to NBA players, as the most overrated player in the league, to which
overrate
he responds.
Overrate that
after you know the game-winning layup on Giannis. Like it's there's so much colliding in this first round, and maybe when you have so many things like that colliding, it's pretty it's to be expected that you're going to wind up down final seconds, one shot to take it all, and we're seeing that an awful lot this postseason, as you said, with our big number 11.
Dude, it's crazy. And yeah, we've had some blowouts, obviously, in the Memphis OKC series, and the Cleveland Miami series was like over before it even started. And like you're seeing Eric Spoelstra talk and Tyler Hero talk. I can't wait for the Pat Riley press conference after what they got embarrassed. I pulled it up. It was like the worst defensive rating in NBA history for like a postseason. They gave 137 points per 100 possessions to the Cleveland Cavaliers, and the Cavs are amazing. But I thought that Bam Adebayo defense would have a little bit more left in the tank, but they completely folded against the Cavs. So this has been an epic postseason so far. Even with the blowouts, when we are seeing all of these close games, we got three straight close games, not great for our sleep habits, not great for our fingernails in the Knicks-Pistons series. We've got three other really close games and buzzer beaters over on the Denver Clippers side, 11 total. I got to ask, because we've been covering the league a very long time, I think this is on track to be the most competitive first round, maybe the most competitive postseason, if it stays like this, we've seen in a long time. Dan, is this the most bananas first round you can remember?
All right. So what kind of scale do we get for bananas? Is it like, is it a 1 to 10? Is it a, you know, a Lucy to a bunch? What's the banana scale that we're working with?
Let's go with 10 bananas. I almost went into like that 100 man versus one gorilla thing.
Yeah, no.
But that currency, I'm not going to hit into because that might be the entire big number episode this week.
That's right.
But Dan, let's go with 10 bananas. How many bananas are you grading this postseason so far?
So I'm going to go 6 bananas. And so that it sounds low considering what we were just talked about. But you do have to remember, as you said, we've got 2 sweeps. We've already got the 2 sweeps. And we've got 2 5-game series with the Celtics taking out the Magic and the Pacers finishing off the Bucks. So that we've already got, you know, we're past that a little bit early. That reduces it sort of brings down the average.
Sure. And I'll give you
I've
that.
I got to give you. So I did a little reporting here, a little pre-pro. Our friend Mike Bowie runs the wonderful website Unpredictable, you know, fantastic win probability charts. He tracks stuff like the excitement index of a game, which is like how wildly the win probability vacillates. Comeback factor, like how much a team had to like overcome to get back and raise their win probability. Tension, how often the game is like at a 50-50 win probability, all these sorts of things. And I asked him, because I said, like, Tom's asking me this question. I'm dumb and don't know. I got to ask a smart person. How does this rate in terms of the wildest first rounds we've ever seen? And he got back to me because he's a mensch. And he said, he was curious too. So he went back to 1997, start of the play-by-play era, right? Where we've got the possession-by-possession details. Average excitement index is 14th out of 29, middle of the pack. Mm-hmm. Average comeback factor, 5th out of 29. So again, pretty good, but like not as many huge, like gigantic comebacks. Tensions index, surprisingly, like how close the game is throughout the game, 23rd out of 29 first rounds. And so that's, I think a lot of that is congested into the Knicks series, but there have been more spreads and more swings in other areas. So I think the illustrative part of this is my brain is such mush that I forget how close other postseasons were because I was like, oh, this is totally it. But the other thing is, so even though it doesn't rise to the absolute, like the peak of the most wild first round that we've seen in the last 29, 30 years, there still have been four games that are like 90th percentile or higher in tension index, where there is that like completely like split 50-50 win probability. You had Nuggets Clippers game two, which was the Kawhi game where he just went absolutely bonkers. Rockets Warriors game four, where Jimmy had his monster second half and Draymond gets the stop on Şengün. Knicks Pistons game four last night, which whatever the hell that was. And then Lakers Wolves game three, where the Wolves take that sort of commanding 2-1 lead. And that doesn't include Pacers Bucks game five, which was like the wildest swing. Clippers Nuggets game four with the Aaron Gordon buzzer beating game winning dunk at the absolute last millisecond. Or Thunder Grizzlies game three, where OKC erased the 28-point deficit and came all the way back. So like, even with like what we're seeing is a ton of these games night in and night out, and it still doesn't go all the way back to like the most wild swings in one postseason. So the lesson here is NBA basketball, especially in the first round of the playoffs, can be absolutely mind-bendingly intense. And every time you look at it, in an individual postseason, chances are you're going to say, well, this has been wilder than I expected, because at this time of the year, what you expect should be wild swings.
Yeah, wild. And like, I think the bar is 2014, right? Would you agree with that? Like 2014, that postseason in this metric, by this prism of one possession games, games decided by 3 points or fewer, that one had 15 in the first round. So we're at 11 right now as of this recording. And we might hit 15 when it's all said and done by the end of the first round. We've had the sweeps, like you mentioned. We've had these 50-point, 60-point margins in some of these games, which is weighting down a lot of those metrics that you saw. But like, there's so many games going on in the first round every year. It's always so hard for us to cover all of these games that like, if we just have one crazy game a night, I'm like, it melts the brain, and we're getting that every single night, Dan. So 11 of these games, there were 15 in 2014. That one was, that was the Dame walk-off year in Houston, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, if we can spare 30 seconds or 60 seconds for a walk down memory lane for 2014. 5 of the 8 series in the first round went the distance, 7-game series. Nets, Raptors, Pacers, Hawks, Clippers, Warriors, Thunder, Grizzlies, Spurs, Mavs. One that didn't was Blazers, Rockets, that had the Dame Game 6 walk-off series-ending 3-pointer. So like the most iconic shot of that was not one of the 7-game series. You had Vince Carter, old man Vince Carter, hitting a game-winning 3 in the corner in Spurs, Mavs Game 3. You had Zach Randolph getting suspended for Game 7 of Thunder, Grizzlies for clocking Steven Adams yep. in the jaw. Yep. Which Steven Adams just walked through like, oh, right, he hit me. I didn't even realize that. Our shout to our overlord, Matt Ufford, saying 4 straight games of Grizzlies Thunder went to overtime in that series. So like even within that series, the intensity. Clippers Warriors, game 7 was a 2-point game with 13 seconds left. And I think that was like one of the last, it was like the last time that the Steph Warriors lost a series in the West for years and years and years. Pacers Hawks, I have to just get this off my chest. The Pero Antic series.
Yes.
Real heads forget? No. This was when Mike Budenholzer is the underdog and saying, we got to figure out something to do against the first seeded Pacers. We're putting a stretch 5 out there. We're spreading the floor. And Roy Hibbert, you could see his eyes widen and maybe his life flashing before his eyes, because that was like the future was coming and it was going to be stretch bigs who were punishing drop back bigs. And Roy Hibbert's career changed dramatically after that. And then Nets Raptors, I remember watching the last play of that game or that series was Kyle Lowry driving on Paul Pierce. Paul Pierce blocks him. And of course, as we know, that whole era of the Brooklyn Nets was totally justified in that one series win. Everything worked out great for them from there on out. So all which to say, who knows how many people even remember the 2014 first round, but that was the intensity just like condensed within that one series. And we see it year after year. We are seeing it again this year. May we get three or four more of those tight games to reach us to a new level 16. That would be wonderful. If for no other reason, then we just need to be remember. In 10 years, I want to be remembering this year like that with 2014, what we're just doing now. It's wild that our brains are broken. Tight games everywhere you look.
I mean, any of those series or any of those games that you mentioned as cataclysmic as what we saw in Indianapolis with the Milwaukee Bucks and what happened to Giannis. We're going to talk about that later in the program and what that means for the Milwaukee Bucks, whether they trade Giannis or whether they decide to like run it back next year, even though Damian Lillard is out with a torn Achilles. What happens to Doc Rivers? Does Houston, if they lose this series to the Golden State Warriors, like, did the loser of that series get Giannis as a consolation prize? Like, who's going to have the most? Prize. It's a pretty great one, which begs the question, like, what happens with Giannis going forward? That post-game press conference, we're going to talk about it later in the program. But first, we're going to talk about this series that you attended on Tuesday night, Knicks Pistons, four little numbers coming from Dan Devine. We're going to riff about that series that feels like, to me, kind of the same vibes as we had last year between the Pacers and the Knicks. We'll get into that right after the break. All right, Dan, four little numbers on Knicks Pistons. What's the first one you got for me?
First little number this week is +21.7. That's the on-court, off-court swing for Cade Cunningham through five games in the series, according to our friends at Cleaning the Glass. With him in the game, Detroit outscoring New York by 2.2 points per 100. With him out of the game, outscored by 19.5 points per 100. So there's your big swing. There's your 21.7. I added it up and checked. Raw numbers, 204 minutes on the floor. Detroit's +11. 36 he sat across five games. Only 36 minutes of rest across five games. New York +16. So what we're seeing from Cade Cunningham, and we knew this, you know, when Jaden Ivey went down, they lost their, you know, main secondary creator. They brought Dennis Schroeder in to be another ball handler, but they've chosen to play him. JB Bickerstaff has had Schroeder alongside Cade Cunningham a lot to try to get Cade off the ball, get more ball handling out there. Cade leads the postseason in time of possession. He's eighth in usage rate, has created more points via assist than anybody but Tyrese Halliburton and Nikola Jokic, which is to say it's kind of what we saw from Cade Cunningham in the regular season. And for a 23-year-old in his first taste of playoff basketball, pretty impressive, no?
Dude, he's been awesome. And to do that in the fourth quarter where he came alive and destroyed the Knicks at Madison Square Garden as in his first playoff kind of elimination game, it was incredible to see how he kind of went right at OG Anunoby after he has gotten blocked, I think, three times earlier in the game, whether it was him or Mikal Bridges. They seem to be able to snuff out anything Cade Cunningham wanted to do in the first three quarters. And then he was just like unstoppable. There was that one drive where he went coast to coast and finished among like four trees there in the final couple minutes there where it was just, he's unflappable. Dude's 23 in his first postseason, and he looks like the most steely guy out there. You know, like, damn, when you're watching Cade Cunningham play, he seems just totally solid. And down the stretch, a lot of big plays by him. The three-pointer where he was just the dagger, where it was just like, dude, who steps up at Madison Square Garden against that team, a team that wants to win a championship? They bring in Karl Anthony Towns, and that dude, Cade Cunningham, was the best player on the floor down the stretch. I love what I've seen from him at 23 years old, just kind of symbolic of what this Detroit Pistons team is, way ahead of schedule. And Cade Cunningham performing like this is emblematic of that.
Absolutely. Our friend Justin Kubatko at Statitudes notes that Cade is the third player in NBA history with at least 120 points, 40 rebounds, and 40 assists through his first five postseason games. The other two guys are Oscar Robertson and Luka Doncic. So decent company to be in for an all-everything creator. You mentioned Cade grabbing the ball off the rim, going end-to-end, being able to make the Knicks pay on their defensive end. Brings me to my second little number here, because that's not something the Knicks do all that often. Second little number is 15.84. Stick with me. That's how many seconds New York's average offensive possession has lasted in this series, according to PBPstats.com. So you've got 24 seconds on the shot clock, right? And the average Knicks possession is right up near 16 seconds. It's about a half second lower than their average during the regular season, which was already near the bottom of the league. 15.84 would have been the slowest average possession in the during every regular season going back to 2016. This is not shocking. We know that Jalen Brunson likes to be he's the operator. He wants to go ISO. He wants to run pick and roll. He wants to target a matchup. We know that Tom Thibodeau's teams have typically played at slower paces because when you start cranking the pace up, you might turn the ball over, and he wants to emphasize the possession game, all those sorts of things. But so often in this series, as somebody who's covered a few games of it, it really feels evident, like leaps off the screen, that they're like super slow getting into their sets. They're not, you know, starting their actions more than halfway through the clock, not even getting into anything until there's 11, 12, 10 seconds left on the clock. And by doing so, it really leaves the Pistons only having to make like one defensive play to send the Knicks into chaos. By comparison, the Pistons, 14.37 seconds per offensive possession, only OKC has been faster. So you see there's a lot more of those Cade grabbing it, Asar Thompson grabbing it, Schroeder grabbing it, whoever, end-to-end push. What have you made of the Knicks' pace in this series? Because it was a point of contention, something that came up a bunch of times in the post-game press conferences, and I'm wondering what that looks like from somebody watching it a little bit more removed than I was in the arena.
Yeah, so many coaches talk about the sixth defender, and that's the shot clock. Is like once you start getting into the last few seconds of the shot clock, you introduce a turnover, a shot clock violation. It's kind of one of those things you'd like to avoid every time down the floor, is getting to a point where you have to hand grenade, kick it out to Josh Hart, kick it out to Jalen Brunson, and just throw one up. The New York Knicks are doing that seemingly every other time down the floor. And it's mind-boggling to me, Dan, when you look at Tom Thibodeau and the way he's utilized these lineups, why does it feel like they haven't played offense together? It feels like a lot of the time, Karl-Anthony Towns gets left alone for an entire fourth quarter. He doesn't get a touch down the stretch. I felt like he was kind of left alone in this one down the stretch as well, where I'm like, this lineup, the five-man lineup of OG Anunoby, Karl-Anthony Towns, Josh Hart, Mikal Bridges, and Jalen Brunson, they played over 2,200 minutes together in the regular season, which was more than 600 more minutes than any other lineup in the NBA. So they played the most minutes together, and yet it seems like they don't really know what kind of actions they want to get to. They don't seem like they have a lot of synergy, chemistry offensively. It seems very disjointed, where you go and you have 21% of your possessions ending in the final 4 seconds of the shot clock. That is the most for any team this postseason, and it feels that way. The efficiency is garbage when you get to those last few seconds. And this is what J.B. Bickerstaff wants. He wants to have Asar Thompson hound Jalen Brunson, exhaust him to the point where they're just flailing at the end of these possessions. And this is one of the biggest indictments of Tom Thibodeau's team this year, is despite having so many extreme minutes together, that starting lineup still doesn't feel like a cohesive unit. And I feel like this offense should be way better than it is. But a lot of it is due to the fact that they've just basically had Jalen Brunson run everything. And I know we're going to get to it eventually, right? Like, how do you have Jalen Brunson off the floor in those crucial moments down the stretch and not call a timeout? Because that to me was the game. That to me was like, you break the glass in case of emergency, you use your final timeout, and still Tom Thibodeau holds on to that timeout. And by the time he gets Jalen Brunson and Josh Hart in the game, it's already over.
Yeah, I wrote about this, wrote like a newser about this last night at Yahoo Sports, and Tom Thibodeau's explanation for it was not so much an explanation as just saying, yeah, just where we were at with timeouts in the game, just coach's decision. And they had one timeout left, and you know, coaches want to make sure they hold on to it to be able to advance the ball. If they get the ball under the basket, they need one more possession. There's a defensible argument to be made for why not calling a timeout. Less so, I think, not fouling in that situation, not having somebody commit a foul. The argument would be they were already in the bonus, so any foul was going to send Detroit to the foul line. But if that's the cost of doing business to get two of your five most important players on the floor, I think that you can make an argument there. Thibodeau didn't really make the argument. He just said there's a lot of things that you consider about it. I chose this way. It seemed it kind of hurt the Knicks quite a bit. Maybe not the reason they lost the game, but it certainly was a difficult one when you're down two possessions late. That's why you've got Jalen Brunson. He's the clutch player of the year. The whole idea is to build the whole plane out of him getting you good shots against tough defenses in the biggest moments. They were not able to do that. The whole point of Josh Hart is to go make the effort, hustle, effort, energy play that nobody else is going to make on the floor in those moments. He has done it countless times before. He was not available to do it. So the Knicks go down with Campaign and Deuce McBride on the floor, and that's a bitter pill to swallow. And when you had a closeout opportunity, to your point, the starting lineup is getting worse too. The trend line is, you know, they were plus 3.3 points per 100 in the beginning part of the regular season, down from January 1st, really bad since the All-Star break. It feels like it's retreating rather than advancing at this time of year, which is not what you want. What you do want, though, if you're the Detroit Pistons, that's our third little number, 18. That's how many assists center Jalen Duren has in this series, with 10 of them coming in the last two games, including 6 in game 5. Being able to have a center who can make plays with the ball in his hands is really useful when a team wants to take your primary playmaker away in the pick and roll. And that's what the Knicks have been doing. They've been sending two defenders at Cade Cunningham, trying to force the ball out of his hand. And Detroit has had to say, we got to find another way to play if they're going to blitz us. There's Jalen Duren in the middle of the floor, rolling, getting the ball. We've seen, obviously, Draymond Green is like your apex version of this, we've seen, right? But you get a big who can make a play, who can read the floor and make a pass in the middle of the floor. Duren's been doing that. He's been super comfortable making plays in the pocket. He found Asar Thompson on a handful of dunks. I think like 6 or 7 of Asar Thompson's baskets in this series have been Duren finding him for a dunk on the back line.
Yeah, the tic-tac-toe, like getting him the ball in that release lever. And then you have, of course, Asar Thompson, one of the best athletes in the NBA, just in that dunker spot every time. And I love Jalen Duren, just the bounce pass, the lobs. Like, he's been fantastic in that role.
And Bickerstaff is super comfortable with him there. You know, he feels like the quote last night was, there was a stretch during the year, I think he went like 6 games in a row where he had 6-plus assists. He's got great feel with the ball in his hands. I think you had checked it was 6 games with 5-plus assists. So we'll fact check JB on that one. But having it on the fly there was pretty impressive for our boy JB Bickerstaff. As we talked about for the first run for Cade Cunningham at age 23, first run for Asar Thompson, Jalen Duren's only 21. What have you made of him in his first postseason?
Yeah, when he collapsed, when he got his legs taken out from under him, when Mitchell Robinson kind of had that.
That was scary.
How many of those have happened in this postseason? Yeah, we've had the most electric postseason by that stat we had at the top, but also a lot of scary falls this postseason.
Yeah.
That one, the Jalen Duren, dude, that guy is a rock. He's jacked. Also, if I fell like as hard as he did onto the hardwood there, I would have snapped like a twig. That dude is so strong. I can't believe he's 21 years old. And he's been really skilled in this series, like huge for them in rebounds and in those passes. The offensive rebounds where Karl Anthony Towns just decides, I'm going to go leave this dude and try to block Cade Cunningham at the rim, even though it's exposing me on the offensive rebound and on the post putbacks. It seemed like either Jalen Duren was going to get that putback or he was going to find Asar Thompson for an easy dunk. To have that guy, to have that release valve, already doing this at age 21, opposite Karl Anthony Towns, and oftentimes looking like the most stable player, the most solid player, and just making smart plays. I love what I'm seeing from the youngsters. Like, they do not look 23, and Asar Thompson just turned 22. I loved that we got to see Asar Thompson guarding Jalen Brunson down the stretch. I wanted to see more of that. Earlier in this series, they decided to go with Dennis Schroeder because of the offense, but Asar has been really, really developing before our eyes. So they have just an amazing core, and Jalen Duren, the Knicks passed on that dude. They traded Kemba Walker to Detroit in a salary dump a couple years ago and attached Jalen Duren's first round pick. They traded away Jalen Duren to the Detroit Pistons. So this is kind of a really interesting story of Jalen Duren. I love his game and the fact that he's this strong, this smart, and this useful in a postseason experience. This dude has a really bright future, and I love what the Detroit Pistons have in Jalen Duren.
From bright futures to gray presents, our fourth little number, 85.5, which is the Knicks' offensive rating with Jalen Brunson off the floor in this series. That's bad. That's like worse than the worst offenses you'd ever imagine. Like, if you multiplied the lockout era Bobcats by the process era Sixers, the offense might look something like 85.5 points per 100 possessions. No matter what other combination of Knicks is on the floor, Cat, Mikal Bridges, Josh Hart, OG Anunoby, whoever, they have just not consistently generated good looks against this Pistons defense without Brunson there. And on one level, plenty of credit, goes to Detroit. That's been, I think they were a top five caliber defense for the last 50 or so games of the season. JB Bickerstaff has that team super locked in. On the other, though, shouldn't a team with that much non-Brunson talent be able to generate something better than this?
Dude, that's an astounding stat. Like, this is kind of the bet that they made, right? By leaning so hard on Jalen Brunson in clutch situations and using that five-man lineup like all the time, when stuff hits the fan and you're not having Jalen Brunson on the floor because he turns his ankle or what have you, gets in foul trouble, not being useful defensively, what have you, you have to take him off the floor, and having everything crumble, that's kind of the problem. Like, the problem is when you lean so hard on running these guys into the ground and playing these kind of minutes in the regular season is what happens when you don't have them on the floor. A lot of other teams have different looks, different options that they practice, that they've run through the reps in the regular season. And it seems like you're not getting the upside of having Jalen Brunson do everything offensively. And you're not getting the kind of, you're getting all of the downside, which is that they don't look like they know how to play basketball without Jalen at the controls. And that speaks to just roster configurations. That campaign is the guy, or Deuce McBride had a really strong start to the season and feels like he's tapered off a little bit. But the fact of the matter is that Jalen Brunson, you need him on the floor to do everything offensively, and it's still not an elite offense. They got to figure this out. This, you know, going to Detroit for game six, it feels, with Josh Hart having that fall onto the ground late, and it seemed like he seemed to be banged up at the end of that game, why he had to check out and leave the court, it feels like an ominous retelling of what happened against Indiana last year, where just the roster kind of fell apart before our eyes. And it was like, maybe that doesn't happen this year. But it's kind of this, the boogeyman is at the door, Dan, and it feels like this might be last year all over again, where they just don't have enough juice. And the fact of the matter is, this team, when they acquired Karl-Anthony Towns, if I told you his usage rate in the postseason would be 21%, basically a role player, you'd be like, nah, man, like, he needs to be way up there as like a much stronger second option, especially if Jalen Brunson's banged up and not 100%. You need to lean on Karl-Anthony Towns more. They just haven't been able to do that.
And if you wind up after last year running aground in the seventh game of the second round, if you wind up this year running around in the seventh game of the first round against a young first-time entry Pistons team, I think Tom Thibodeau is going to have some awfully big questions to answer. Maybe Leon Rose is going to have some awfully big questions to answer about Tom Thibodeau, but we'll see where we get to after that. That's our four little numbers, Tom. What do we got next?
Yeah, we're going to talk about another, I guess, in the Tom Thibodeau coaching tree, or someone that he's very close to, Doc Rivers. He was a top assistant for Doc all those years. And we're going to talk about that epic meltdown in the Indiana series and what that future holds, what holds for the future for Giannis and Antetokounmpo and the Milwaukee Bucks that just won a championship a few years ago and now looks like on the brink of blowing it all up. So we'll talk about that right after the break. So it wasn't a 3-1 lead that Doc Rivers and his team blew in this series. They weren't up 3-1 against the Indiana Pacers. It felt like it based on this game five, where it was they were up 33-13 early in this game.
Lots of threes and ones in there. So, I mean,
kind of same numerology there, right? Yes, right in the same neighborhood. You got it goes into overtime. It's a 7-point game with 40 seconds left. And our friend Mike Bowie at unpredictable.com has these win probability charts that, like, I had to like zoom in to get to the right moment to see when the apex of the Milwaukee Bucks win probability was. It was 99.7% odds of winning that game. And like, I don't need the math to like the nitty gritty win probability algorithm to like explain that, but it just 99.7% chance of winning. And then all hell breaks loose. Gary Trent, who is very much the reason why they were up by that much at that point in the game, it kind of unraveled. And you had this incredible comeback by Tyrese Haliburton, where he gets the one-on-one on Giannis Antetokounmpo. And the fact that he was like, Pascal Siakam came out to set the screen, almost that they wanted that mismatch or Tyrese, that matchup, Tyrese going at Giannis, all of the stakes of this series and the jawing back and forth, to have Giannis and Tyrese in that moment where Giannis has to just get one stop to keep his season alive, and he opens up his hips and Tyrese goes right at the cup and finishes on Giannis Antetokounmpo for the game-winning bucket. Afterwards, Tyrese Halliburton's father came out onto the court and stared down Giannis in a really bizarre moment where he's taunting Giannis, apparently using some extracurriculars in there, and basically asking to be punched in the jaw for some reason. Like, why are you doing that? Giannis Antetokounmpo took the high road after the game, and I gotta tell you, Dan, I don't think I would have handled that half as well as Giannis Antetokounmpo. Given what just preceded that moment, the season, Damian Lillard being out with a torn Achilles just hours before, and then you have this dude walking up on you and basically stepping, and you're like not reacting, you're just like taking it easy. They go through all the handshakes, and then Bennedict Mathurin, they have this weird hug and it gets a little out of control. They had to be separated. Man, that was crazy enough, but like it kind of overall of this is this ominous feeling that this is all over in Milwaukee. Like I have people texting me, my friends in Milwaukee and like lifelong friends being like, I hate to say it, but we got to trade Giannis. And that's how big that moment was. That's how crazy that series was. That I feel like, I don't know, we're probably not sitting here 9 times out of 10 saying, I think the Milwaukee Bucks have to trade Giannis this summer. But the way that ended and the way things transpired with Damian Lillard, it feels like that's where we're headed, is just 3 years after winning the title, we're seeing that Giannis Antetokounmpo might be on his way out.
It's the bill coming due for the trades that the Bucks have made to try to maximize this Giannis window, right? It's some of the picks that they're out. I think one more this year and then a swap next year to the Pelicans. That's because they traded those to New Orleans for Jrue Holiday, which is what created the team that won the championship. And so like, that's, you do that 100 times out of 100, right? After that team runs afoul of Jimmy Butler in the Heat and the Celtics in the second or in the first round, like you wind up in the situation where there's another level we need to get to. So trade for Damian Lillard. Again, I think almost everybody who evaluates these sorts of things was like, no, like phenomenal. Absolutely. The Drew's offensive struggles in the playoffs have rendered him a non-factor in some of these series. You got to elevate. So bring in Damian Lillard. Absolutely, like world-class pick and roll operator, floor spacer, crunch time general, guy who can pair with Giannis. Everybody understood the logic. It just hasn't worked out. And, with injuries being a massive factor in there, Chris Middleton, who then gets traded for Kyle Kuzma, who was one of the worst players in the first round of the playoffs, to the point where Doc went away from him by series end, perhaps even too late. You now wind up in a situation where our colleague Ben Rohrbach wrote about this in a similar idea. Like, it's time for them to do it. No control, not the Bucks don't have control over their own first round picks from 2025 through 2030. And are out almost all of their second round picks too. I believe like there was that deal where they sent, I think, 4 or 5 out for Jay Crowder, who barely played for them. There's just, the cupboard is really bare. And you're looking at, I think it's about $134 million in guaranteed salary on the books next year, just for Giannis, Dame, and Kuzma, just for those three guys, getting you very, very close to where the cap line's going to be before you fill out the rest of the team. You're not left with a whole lot of outs for how to pivot back from this or move out of, find a new way to rebuild around Giannis, which then leads you to that question of, do you rebuild by moving Giannis? And I think the John Horst got an extension right before this. So I guess he's going to be the guy that's going to shepherd it and foresee it, or oversee it rather, be the foreman on the rebuild. But obviously,
shepherd,
I think
you say shepherd. You say.
Yeah, like, Tommy Shepherd and
no, I'm going Reed Shepherd on that one. Is Reed Shepherd?
See, I was thinking about well-timed executive extensions and Tommy Shepherd in Washington, but that's yeah. So, talk to me about Reed Shepherd.
Oh, I'm just saying, like, I could see this Warriors and Rockets epic series that we're seeing between these two teams. Tim McMahon over at ESPN.com reporting on Wednesday that there's only one untouchable player on that roster, and that's Amen Thompson, who, as the listeners of this show know, very near and dear to our hearts. Amen Thompson being the only untouchable guy on the roster, according to Tim McMahon's sources over with the Houston Rockets, which means Alpi Şengün and Jalen Green and Reed Shepard seemingly could be up for grabs if someone like Giannis was on the table. I don't know how you get bigger than Giannis, whether it's Kevin Durant. I think Giannis has more trade value than Kevin Durant at this age. And so I do think that that is a likely landing spot or a likely suitor for Giannis Antetokounmpo if things went that way. I suspect that the San Antonio Spurs will be in there because of the fact that they've got all of these chips that they're sitting on. I don't see OKC, Dan. Oddly enough, I feel like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Giannis aren't a great fit next to each other, and you might argue, like, just get all the talent that you want, but, like, I feel like they need more shooting around those two guys. If you're going to get Shai, you get more, maximize him by having shooting around him. Giannis, obviously not a three-point shooter, a guy who's able to play a five-out system where he's kind of watching Shai go to work. But, of course, the defense and the athleticism and the one-man offense that you're getting in Giannis, maybe you can make that work. But I think Houston, given Ime Udoka, and we know that he wants to win right now, I kind of feel like the Houston Rockets make the most sense to kind of push their chips to the middle with a guy like Reed Shepard that I think Milwaukee would look at and say, like, we want an exciting young player. And yes, we're not going to have Giannis. We don't have Dame. But maybe bring in Reed Shepard as kind of this amazing shooter, floor spacer that can work under Damian Lillard as like the assistant coach. And that can be one of the centerpieces in a potential Giannis trade. And Houston has these picks that they got from Brooklyn last year. It feels like that is a very realistic option if Giannis Antetokounmpo decides, you know what? I want to go win a championship right now. Let's come to a deal. Let's see what's out there. I could also see, Dan, the Golden State Warriors getting into this. I just don't know if they have the right number of assets that Milwaukee would bite on something like that. They've got a lot there. Of course, their older trio, Draymond, Jimmy Butler, and Steph Curry. But outside of that, I'm not so sure that they can come up with a package that would entice Milwaukee to go with them. But then you figure out, like, the only other way that happens is if Giannis forces his way to go play with Steph Curry. We know that you've seen it at all-star games. They love playing with each other in those atmospheres. They share the same agency as well. So you can see how it can kind of play into part where there's backroom deals, or at least they're going to negotiate backroom deals to try to make Giannis end up there if he wanted to go there. But I feel like Houston is the most intriguing Giannis spot. And I get the Kevin Durant stuff, but at 37 years old, I think that's a pretty big gamble. If you're going to put someone like Şengün or put someone like Jalen Green into a deal, I would do that. If it's Jalen Green, I'm not so sure Şengün, I would put that into a deal. But man, Milwaukee has some decisions to make, and it just feels like this is going to be a tectonic plate moving summer for the Milwaukee Bucks. And it, like, I don't know if there's a precedent for this. Like, maybe Kawhi in San Antonio, where it just was like, you know what, you won a championship here, but I mean, that was an ugly breakup, and I hope it doesn't come to that with Milwaukee and Giannis.
Yeah, given everything that he's meant to that organization, that city, the culture there, you like to see, I mean, ideally a more beneficial outcome or exit strategy than worked out with like Dame in Portland, where, I mean, I think the good feelings toward Dame can, you know, persist in Portland, but like it wasn't getting him to where his preferred destination was. It was, you know, but you tried to get him to a place where he could compete and contend. And that's why, I mean, like, if you're thinking about what the Bucks would want back, my first thought is, well, if I'm going to be terrible, I want my picks back. So where are my picks? And like New Orleans, I guess, like I said, still has one. And then there's the ones that are out from the
Portland and New Orleans would be the ones where it was like, yeah, man, if we can get our picks back, I think a three team, the only way that works is a three team deal where like picks are going to Milwaukee and then Zion goes to somewhere else.
Which,
I don't
like,
see Zion, like, who is that third team? I think with the new new front office there with Joe Dumars and Troy Weaver, maybe they decide to mix things up and you know, facilitate that trade. I don't see Giannis getting traded to New Orleans or Portland, but hey,
exactly.
Stranger things have happened in the league.
But then, so that leads me to, if that's the case, and we're probably not going to send Giannis to New Orleans or Portland because that, you know, for whatever reason. And if, say, he does like Houston, what's the next best thing to getting my own picks back? It might be getting Suns picks. And Houston does have some of those in the cupboard from the deals that they've made. So it's, you know, like, there's the other part of this, and my brain is too mushy to have worked this all out. But generally speaking, these tend to be like multi-team, larger structures that rather than just one-to-one, unless you're trading Luka. But if this winds up being Giannis has a desired out, if Giannis wants to go, which we don't even know if he would want to do it, but if Giannis decides he wants to go, and he wants to go someplace specific, then it's how do the Bucks turn that into the largest potential cache of assets they can get. And that's not a particularly fun place to be, but at least it's maybe a clarifying moment. Like, we know we took the swing, we made the effort, we did everything we could, maybe not always the wisest moves, but we played our chips to try to get as far as we could with this build and get back to a championship. It did not work. Now here's how we have to move forward. It is a bummer. These things don't end well. Otherwise they wouldn't end. But this is not, I don't think this is what anybody wanted to see happen within the Milwaukee Bucks organization, the ending with the injury and then the catastrophic blown lead and the loss and then leading you to all this. The main thing I will say, just going back to the Halliburton of it all, maybe the best play in the whole situation, Pat Connaughton, maybe one more assist on the way out the door in Milwaukee, keeping Giannis from getting at Papa Halliburton and making sure that nothing escalated there. A consummate professional, an important part of the Milwaukee Bucks organization. One more real big helper there from Pat Connaughton.
Yeah. That could have gotten ugly real fast.
Yeah.
And I'm glad nothing came of it. Giannis,
Tom, I know you love your kids. Do you love your kids that much to go and start woofing at Giannis Antetokounmpo in a moment like that?
See, that feels like not love. That feels like insecurity. That, like, if I love my kids, I wouldn't put my kids in a position where they'd have to apologize on a podium after the game. You know? Like, right, that's what true love is like, hey, I love my kids. They just won the biggest game of their career. What a moment.
Back.
Overrate that. And just let them have the moment. Don't insert yourself into that story, right?
So absolutely.
But that is crazy what he did. And like, yeah, I know some people would be like, yeah, if I was seeing them jaw back and forth, like if I was Tyrese's dad, I would step like. But no, you look like a fool out there. And I'm glad that he apologized, because like, we don't need that. Here's what I'll say. I'm happy for him that he realized he was in the wrong there, because he does that to someone else and he is not going to be, his face is not going to look the same next time he goes out on the floor like that. Like, he's lucky that Giannis is that humble and that cool headed that it didn't get to that point. So Tyrese Halliburton, amazing series. They're going to move on against the Cleveland Cavaliers. Just quick thoughts here. We have 8 minutes of action between Cavs, Pacers this season. They're in the same division. They've had 8 minutes where the four stars on the Cleveland side have played against the two stars on the Indiana side, Pascal Siakam and Tyrese Halliburton. 8 minutes.
It's a big
That's
number.
It. That's all we've seen this year, because of injuries or because of trades or what have you, is those six players that everyone's tuning in to see how they will play against each other. They've only played 8 minutes. And in those 8 minutes, I believe the score is like 24-7 on the Cleveland side. So a small sample size alert, but Cleveland's very good at basketball, and Indiana very good as well. But man, the Cleveland Cavaliers, what they did to the Miami Heat, I think is kind of a harbinger of things to come in the next round. Maybe not a sweep, but I would not be surprised if this is over in five.
Yeah, our colleague Ben Rohrbach is going to be writing the preview on this one, so I haven't thought as much about the matchup just yet. But my first thought is, I love Andrew Nembhard. I'm not going to get into all the reasons why, but he's an incredible point of attack defender, a super useful guy. He can't guard both of Garland and Mitchell. So if Garland is healthy and after spraining his big toe, and he's able to go, you know, full blast for the start of the series, Tyrese Halliburton's going to have to guard somebody. And my guess would be that Kenny Atkinson is going to hammer that pain point until Indiana shows that they've got an answer for it. Rick Carlisle is, of course, they're very used to Halliburton being hunted. They've got ways to move around it. But I don't know that most of the teams that have hunted Halliburton have had the overall offensive skill and shooting and playmaking that Cleveland does. So I think the Pacers are great, and I think they're going to stress out Cleveland's coverages and, you know, force them to answer some tough questions. But, you know, we've talked about it a number of times. I've kind of been on this all year. I think the Cavs are going to show that they're not just a very good team. They're a great team. And it wouldn't surprise me if that one wrapped up quickly. But a lot of respect for what Indiana has built and has done, because I think a lot of people thought that about the Knicks series last year, too. And they wind up going all the way to the conference finals. Wouldn't be a total shocker if that happened. But I think this Cavs team is extremely serious and ready to roll.
The diff. The
it's gonna
diff
be a big
in
diff.
That first, it's going to be a big one.
Huge that, friggin' diff.
In that first series, Cavs-Miami, right? The diff in that series was plus 122 in four games. That's the big diff. And that's
the
big
number. Diff.
Yeah. There's a lot of small diffs in this postseason. 11 small diffs of three or fewer. That's the big number this week. Dan, thanks so much for sharing your experience over there at Madison Square Garden and going deep into that Knicks Pistons series and what has already been an incredible, bonkers, bananas, electric postseason. I hope it continues. I want to thank our producers, Stone and Mike, and the entire squad that works behind the scenes on this show. Please watch The Big Number on YouTube. Subscribe. Smash that subscribe button. And wherever you listen to podcasts, give us a 5-star rating, please, and tell your friends, tell your pals. We'll be back next week with another episode of The Big Number. Until then, don't try to step to Giannis Antetokounmpo. Just don't. It's going to end poorly for you.